Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Joe Bogdan. Joe's a co-founder of Llama Leadership, and he's the host of the Llama Lounge podcast. He's also currently serving in the U.S. Air Force, and he's agreed to come on the show and share some of his experiences and chat about his time in the Air Force and everything that he's learned along the way. So welcome to the show, Joe. Glad to have you.
Oh, man, it's great to be here, Scott. I'm really grateful that you gave me the opportunity to come on and just share a little bit and have a great conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really, really pleased that you're on the show. I've listened to a few episodes that you've done on your podcast and also on some other shows where you've kind of talked about your background and everything. And to me, it's really interesting to learn about you and kind of the path that you've taken going from your childhood into the military and what you've learned along the way. And so I want to try to get some of that out today in this episode and go from there. So with that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, who is Joe and where did he come from, you know?
All right, cool. So appreciate the opportunity. I'm Joe Bogdan, and I am currently Air Force Chief Master Sergeant stationed at Osan Air Base in the Republic of Korea. So I've been serving about 21 years. I just hit my 21 year mark. Wow. About a week ago. Yeah. So it's been fantastic. I'm married. My wife is also active duty. She's a dental hygienist in the Air Force, a Master Sergeant, and we're out here together and we're just really enjoying Korea. Interesting enough, this is my third tour here in Osan. I was actually born, I consider this second home for me because I was born outside of the gates at Osan Air Base out in Songtan. Back in 1981, and don't remember a lot from that time, but moved to the States as an infant, but I was the only child of a single mom, didn't know my biological father. But my mom met a staff sergeant that was a public affairs NCO here at Osan, and they got married and we moved to the States. So that was when I moved to the States when I was an infant, and don't remember a lot from that time, but I lived over at McGuire Air Force Base in Jersey, and that was my first exposure to the States. Went there. I didn't speak a lick of English. Started going to school. My mom wanted to send me to preschool immediately, so I'm in preschool. I'm not understanding anything that people are saying, and I was pretty much the only person that looked like me at school at the time. So I remember growing up, getting in a lot of fights because I didn't know what people were saying to me, but I could tell it was derogatory. And then my mom told me, man, I remember one thing is you came home one day after a bunch of fights and said, I'm not going back to school until I learn English. So I sat there and met my first hero, which was Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers taught me English by sitting there just watching. It was an interesting childhood. My mother and my stepfather at the time got divorced soon after. They didn't stay married too long. Bounced around the East Coast, and my mother was she didn't speak very good English, and unskilled laborer immigrant. So moved to New York City where she could find some work. I was pretty much a latchkey child at that time. Learned a lot to be independent. Then my mom ended up meeting a construction worker, and then we moved over to Washington State because construction was just booming in the 90s. So moved over there, and that's when I really felt like I was at home. That was the first time I felt home in the great Pacific Northwest, a very progressive area. I felt like I saw people that looked like me a lot more. Right. In that area, and just really appreciated that place. And thus I went to high school there, and then I realized that I needed to do something with my life, man. I joined a delayed entry program for the Army. At 17, right out of high school, I decided that I didn't want to do that because I found out what a combat engineer actually does. So I decided that's probably not for me. I don't see a lot of transferable skills. And I was planning on just doing a 4 or 6 year and then get out and go back in the civilian community. And so I got out of that contract and joined the Air Force. I became an electrical power production guy, a hybrid generator, electrical mechanic. And, you know, still plan on 4 to 6 years and ended up 21 years later, still here, loving my life, loving the career and just enjoying it. Traveled all over the world, been over in USAFE and Europe, and been in Pacific Air Forces over in Korea and Japan quite a bit of my career. And then did some career broadening in social services for a little while too. Just 4 years of that, where I kind of like rounded out and became a more well-rounded leader, learned some critical skills that I just didn't have, like empathy, kindness and generosity until I started working there. And really, man, I'm just living life. I'm loving it. And I'm just grateful for these opportunities to talk to amazing people like you, Scott.
Hey, that's great. And I appreciate you sharing a little bit about your background. I think that sometimes helps kind of shape the conversation so people understand, you know, who you are, where you're coming from, especially with a childhood like the one that you had, where you were an immigrant, you came into this country not knowing how to speak English. That's a challenge in and of itself, which you had to overcome, and figuring out this whole new culture, this whole new, you know, way of life, and the culture within the United States for, you know, people like yourself who've lived in different parts of the country, is totally different from one place to another. The Northeast is different from the Southeast, yeah, from the Northwest to the, you know, the Central. Like there's just so many different cultures throughout the country, and we have one shared culture too. But you know, where a lot of things, you know, certain holidays and stuff, it's all shared. But just the way people interact with each other and everything is different from one place to another, and you know, that's it's probably difficult as a young kid coming into this whole new world and trying to wrap your head around all that stuff. So it's kind of interesting to see that. So you said that you were in the delayed entry program with the Army, but kind of wanted to switch out of that. What made you go into the Air Force, and how did you come to that conclusion?
So interesting, and I'll kind of backtrack a little bit on that story. So I'm 17 years old. I'm thinking, man, you know, I'm a young kid. I'm like, I want to be a badass. I want to join the Army. So I joined the delayed entry program. I'm working at Wendy's at the time or something, you know, and I'm like, all right, let's go do this. I do that. And then I realized, like I said, there was actually a lot of veterans that worked at Wendy's with me, you know, and a lot of them were Army. And they're telling me, like, do you know what that does? And I was like, well, I thought, you know, it's cool. It'd be engineering stuff in a combat environment. I think that's pretty cool. And they're like, well, you're really just going to be like blowing stuff up a lot and being right in the field nonstop. And I was like, wait, what? So I got out of that program, and the recruiter, the Army recruiter, he told me, he was like, well, if you do that, you're not going to be able to join any other service for 2 years. And I was like, I don't care. I'm fine. Whatever. So I get out. About a year later, the same recruiting office calls me and says, hey, you wondering if you changed your mind? And I was like, well, why would you call me to ask me if I could change my mind if you said I can't join any service for 2 years? That doesn't make any sense. Right. So at that point, my life was just kind of like, you know, my mother had a lot of relationship issues, and they had some gambling issues and money, all kinds of just stuff, you know. And we were just living check to check, and I was being the sole provider at that point, you know, fast forward a little bit into this year later. And we were getting evicted from the house, and I was hanging out around a lot of great people, but also some people that probably, you know, weren't great influences. So I just saw bad things happening. So I was like, man, well, this person just called me and asked me a question that makes me feel like the door's open, that maybe he wasn't being fully honest about me not being able to join any service for 2 years. I talked to my uncle, who was a retired chief master sergeant, and he said, why did you ever think about joining the Army anyway? Why don't you join the Air Force? That's, you know, that's our family business. So I went to the Air Force recruiter, asked them, hey, this guy told me I can't join any service for 2 years because I got out of the delayed entry program. Is that true? And he said, I don't think so. Let me look that up. And they went to policy and said, no, that's completely BS. You can join. You have your DD-214. You can join.
And, wait a minute.
Know, I'm in the Air Force.
wait, a recruiter lied to you? Oh my gosh. I can't believe it.
Yeah. And I don't mean, you know, I don't want to bash on recruiters. I have a lot of your friends that do some great work in that. But yeah, that was definitely my first engagement with a recruiter. The guy was very slick and, yeah, so that's kind of the story. And, you know, I told them this time, the Air Force recruiter, I said, hey, get me a job that I can leave ASAP. Because if I sit here and have time to think about it, you know what happens when you're a young teenager, like, oh, I got a new girlfriend, I got new reasons to stay here. So I was like, just get me on anything you get me out in the next couple of weeks. And he told me about this job in the civil engineering career field, working on backup power systems. Like, sounds good, send it. And next thing you know, I'm getting yelled at in basic training. So
yeah, so that's you know, and probably another culture shock for you too, where where you're you know, just in a matter of, you know, whatever that was, the 18 years or so from you, you know, coming to the United States, going into the military and everything, you know, you're going from one culture to another, and then now now here you are in boot camp, going through getting yelled at, getting probably trash cans thrown at you and all that kind of stuff that people, people do in there. So, you know, it's funny enough, a whole new world.
Yeah. Funny enough though, like it should have been a whole new world, but growing up in my household, that wasn't like getting yelled at was pretty common, unfortunately, you know, like just kind of growing up and it was just, you know, my mom was the product of what she grew up with. So, you know, just, it was a very, very loud household, let's say.
Okay.
So some of that stuff was actually able to adjust to, but what I found funny is what you said about like how the country is so different, right? In different areas. Yeah. My first assignment was Robins Air Force Base in Warner Robins, Georgia, Middle Georgia. And I had never been to the South before, man. So now I grew up a little bit on the East Coast, from New Jersey to New York City in Jackson Heights, Queens. I move all the way over to the Pacific Northwest, love it. And then I moved to Georgia and I felt like that was my first assignment. I felt like I should have just went overseas. It was so different from anything I've ever experienced.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I meant with the different cultures throughout the country. Yeah. I mean, the South is its own different animal and, you know, it has its own environment down there. And, and I can imagine that being exactly like what you said, feeling like you might as well have been in another country, you know, just really different there. So, so when we talked a couple weeks ago, so we talked before this recording, I was on your podcast a couple weeks ago. And then before that we had chatted a little bit too, but, you mentioned a little bit about your upbringing and you just mentioned it now, with, it was, you know, pretty strict and, you know, a lot of yelling and all that kind of stuff in your family. And so, you had mentioned something about how your upbringing sort of prevented you from kind of pushing outside of your own comfort zone. What was that for you? What was that? Was there some like self-limiting beliefs or, you know, what was going on with that? And how did that impact you in your military career?
Yeah. So, when I was growing up, there was a lot of great things that I learned growing up from my household and essentially my mother. You know, there was a lot of stuff like I was a latchkey child. She was at work a lot. I learned how to be very independent. But at the same time, I had to grow up really quick. My mother didn't speak very good English, so I would have to dodge the bill collectors as an 8-year-old, you know, like, and I'm on the phone and I'm learning how to try to navigate through these situations. It wasn't quite like the show Shameless, but there was a lot of times where we had to figure things out, you know, to get to the next paycheck or whatever that might be, right? And I was a kid who went home and had microwave meals. Basically, that was shopping for the week. We went to get microwave meals because even though I was home alone all the time, I was only allowed to use the microwave, never the stove, in case it caught the place on fire, you know, while she's at work. Sure. So this is kind of the environment that I lived in. And it was in New York City, and it wasn't the nicest area. So, you know, there's a lot of just stay home, don't go out and play because it's dangerous out there. So that was kind of the environment. And then I remember my mother being a first generation immigrant as well. She didn't, you know, in a lot of Asian households, and I know there's a lot of other households and cultures that are similar to this, but this is what I know, right? And a lot of my friends that are Asian experience something similar, is that you get held to the standard. Like when you bring home a 97, the question is, where's the other 3% is? It's not good job, you got an A, you know, it's where, yeah. Well, what happened to the other 3%? And that's the way I was kind of brought up, is like, you got to get perfect. You know, you got to be perfect all the time. Well, and when you didn't, it was rough. It was really rough. Conversations would be had. You'd be even grounded at times, or, you know, like just, there's just all kinds of altercations that could happen. And there was a lot of pressure. And I think I didn't realize it at the time, but I reflected back years later. And I thought about myself as a young airman. And growing up, and I really thought about it, and that environment created this place within me that I did never want to step outside my comfort zone. I never wanted to do anything that I knew I wasn't going to get a perfect on, because what happens is, when you bring on 97 and they always ask where the other 3% is, now I don't want to take an advanced placement course. Because, man, if I take a course that I know that it's going to be very challenging, and I'm not sure if I'm going to succeed and get 100 on, it's going to be bad conversations at home. So now I'm only going to pick stuff that I know I'm going to do well at, right? And so there was a positive part of it, is like, I always want to do well. There's drive. But then there's the other part of it is, oh my goodness, I don't want to step out and possibly fail. So I realized that actually bled into my military career too, because I was only putting myself in situations that I was going to succeed in. I only put my hand up on things that I knew I was going to do well at. And luckily I was talented in a lot of things, but it still limited me. And what even made it worse was that I was being reinforced. That behavior was being reinforced because I was winning awards. I was getting promoted pretty quickly because I was doing so well at those things, but I never stepped outside my comfort zone. And I didn't realize how limited I was, because until I started working at the social service center, because it just totally broadened my horizons and gave me a lot of resiliency skills. And that's when it gave me the time to reflect. I looked back, and when I was an airman, I was angry a lot. I had outbursts. A lot of probably my teammates and friends would probably remember me as kind of being a jerk, you know, and looking self-centered and arrogant and never able to be wrong. And I think that a lot of that came from this feeling that I always have to be right and I need to win right. You know what I mean? Like, I have to win it. Like, even if I'm wrong, I got to figure out how to be right. And maybe that gave me some good debate skills, but it didn't help me build relationships. Right. and I look back at that, and I feel a little bit shameful about the behavior that I had when I was young. But I think it really did, having that reflection now helps me look back at that and grow from it. And when the light turned on, I just started like putting myself in situations that I had no idea if I was going to succeed in. And now I embrace that. I love it. And the world is totally different now. You know, I get to do things that stretch me. I get to learn more. And it's just so much more fulfilling, you know? And I think that you will never find your purpose and meaning if you sit in that box, in that comfort zone. You have to stretch beyond that to really understand and be able to walk in that purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was the tipping point for you? Where did you come to that conclusion that you're like, you know what, I'm kind of weighing myself down here and not allowing myself to achieve all the things that I am capable of achieving because of this? So what was that point for you?
I think it progressed from step one to step two. Step one was having someone that believed in me and saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And that was a mentor who pushed me to step outside and go work social services. So, you know, I did not want to work at the Airman and Family Readiness Center. And each branch has their own version of it, right? You got ACS, you got the Naval Fleet Services. So the Air Force, we call it the Airman and Family Readiness Center. So I had a mentor call me, a previous first sergeant called me, and he was working there, and said, "Hey, do you want to come work over here? I think you'd be great at this job." And I'm like, I didn't even know military work there. You work there? Like, well, that's weird, you know? And he said, "Yeah, I think you'd be great for this job." And I'm like, me? Social services? Like working with families and stuff? I was like, I don't think that's a good fit at all. But, you know, out of respect for him, I was like, "Do you mind if I, you know, think about it for a little bit?" And he's like, "Yeah, absolutely." In my mind, I've already shut down this op. You know, like I'm just like, no way, this is not for me. And then I had another mentor tell me, I was just telling her about it. It's just like, this is, you know, almost kind of blowing it off. Like, yeah, it's funny. He actually thought I'd be good at that. And she was like, well, let's go over there and take a look. And I was like, what? So she was like, let's go over there and see what you'd be doing. So she grabbed me up and we went over there and she knew all the right questions to ask, just like a mentor, you know, a good mentor would. So she walked me through, asked the right questions. And then at the end, I was like, yeah, so see, this isn't really for me. And she said, no, this is 100% for you. You need to do this. You need to step out your comfort zone, try to do something different. And really, I was not convinced, but because I had faith in her, and I didn't want to let her down because clearly she had seen something in me that I didn't see. I took the job, and that was like that first step into stepping completely out of my comfort zone. But I had to get pushed. You know, somebody had to push me. When I was in that job, you know, I think just the work ethic is something I always had. You know, maybe I didn't have the best people skills, but I always had work ethic. So I wanted to do the best at that job. So I had to learn, I had to study, and I did put in the due diligence to figure out how to do this. But at some point, timing just worked out perfect. And this new program called Master Resiliency Training was going on. The Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Army was pushing out this huge program and sending hundreds of soldiers at a time to the University of Pennsylvania to learn about grit and mental toughness. And it was all in efforts to try to figure out the issues with PTSD and soldier suicides that was on the rise in the mid to late 2007-ish, 2008. So this program started really launching. So in the Air Force, we got a couple opportunities to go do that. The Army threw a couple bones to us, and I got to be one of those very few. So you'd have 200 soldiers and maybe 8 airmen in that class. So I got to go do that and spend some time with the Army and get some great training on perspectives, cognitive behavioral therapy, like just understanding self-awareness. And this course that I will still say to this day changed my life. I got to learn from the lessons of Dr. Marty Seligman and Dr. Karen Rivich. And these are just some of the pioneers of positive psychology. And so I gained a lot of skills there. And I remember coming back from that course feeling like, how do I apply these things? And the first thing I came back that I really remember was a challenge was I was trying to clep out of a college test out of a course, and it was on human relations. And I was like, HR? Yeah, we're supervisors in the military, HR masters, because we can't fire anybody. We got to figure out how to do a progressive discipline. We got to figure out what motivates you. We got, you know what I mean? Like, it's nonstop and it's 24 hours a day. You don't get an opportunity to just send somebody home. You got to worry about them. You got to think about whether or not they're healthy. If they're stinky when they come to work, you got to figure out why they're stinky. Like, do they not have money to buy laundry? You know what I mean? You got to go through these things. So like, when it comes to just being a great supervisor and a human relations person, you know, I think military members, you know, we get a crash course in that. So I was like, I'll go clep this. I could test out this class. The first 10 questions on that test were about overseas union agreements. And I was like, I know nothing about this stuff. Oh man, you know, and I thought back, I was like, Joe Bogdan 1 year ago, or even before that class, I would have got up after question 8 that I know nothing about. I would just got up. Yeah. But that resiliency class, you know, I started thinking, I was like, no, wait, let's do one. Some of the lessons I learned, I was like, okay, one frame at a time, one question at a time. Let's just do our best and see. Forget the first 8. Let's live in the now and just do our best. And I got through that test and I barely passed it. You know, and I thought about it. I was like, this is not something I would have done before. So if there's like a light moment, it was that class and just that acknowledge the affirmation of what I learned in that class through that test. You know, it's a small thing, mm-hmm. but I remember that. And then after that, I just applied that, all those skills to everything. I'm not perfect at it till even this day, but relationships are better, stretching out comfort zones. Now recently I even signed up, my church needed some support for audiovisual support. I know nothing about that stuff. But I was like, well, shoot, if you could train me, I'll do it. You know what I mean? Like I'll do it. So I try, I'm always looking for new things to do to keep myself inspired too, as a leader, because if you're not inspired, we've all worked for uninspired leaders at some point in our career. I think that just finding ways to continuously grow keeps you inspired and prevents you from putting the lid of on inspiration of your people, you know, and the growth of your people. So these are just kind of things that I've kind of grown from. But I would say, you know, in a long answer to your question, I think it was a couple things, but being forced out and then getting some lessons and then applying them. I think it all happened between probably year 10 to 12 of my career, honestly. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I like how you're saying how someone kind of pushed you outside of your comfort zone and that mm-hmm. helped you kind of realize that you were capable of mm-hmm. things that you weren't necessarily comfortable with, but you still could do it. Right. And I've experienced the same kind of thing in my life where, what I do now has to do with like website, like programming and things like that. And when I was in college, my dad was starting a company and he needed a website. So I asked him, like, is there anything I could do to help you? You know, he's starting this business. What can I do to help you? And he says, well, I need a website. So build me a website. I was like, oh, I don't know how to build a website. I've never done that before. And he goes, well, go buy a book and figure it out. And this is like early 2000s when it was like before all the YouTube videos and all the, you know, all the, everything was online mm-hmm. at that, you know, it wasn't all online at that point. But I went out and I bought a book to figure out how to do that. And it pushed me like well outside of my comfort zone. I had never done any sort of coding or anything before. And I found out that I actually enjoyed it. And, you know, the process itself sucked, like, because I kept doing things and failing. But then eventually, once I figured things out, I was like, okay, this is actually not that hard. I can do this now. Now I have this other tool in my tool belt that I can use going forward. And I've turned it into a career now. And this is, you know, 20 plus years later, I'm still doing it. And it's very satisfying to be able to look back and see the path that you've taken, the struggles that you've gone through and see the success that comes from that and everything. So I can sort of relate to where you're coming from there, where you kind of get pushed outside of that comfort zone, but then you can look back and see, like, you know what, that wasn't so bad. And you have something that you can be proud of afterwards, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that like your story is very similar in many ways. And I think it's really kind of gets back to that point where I didn't really elaborate on so much was that I think you tend to find your amazing or whatever it is that, you know, that you get to embrace the amazing that is you when you step outside, because it's not going to be in that comfort zone. And this is just my thoughts on it. Like a lot of times you find your purpose and meaning outside of your comfort zone. It's not going to be sitting there. I get like, we all have our strengths, but we don't know what all of our strengths are until we step out, we get exposed to different things. So me, I didn't realize that I would get into such things like resiliency and teaching and all these things. I discovered that when I was outside of my comfort zone. And I don't think I could only imagine if I never did, what potential I'm leaving out there. You know, I'm leaving on a table, and we talk about like, you know, you're at the pearly gates, and then, you know, like Goggins talks about it, and you see a list of things, and you're like, I didn't do any of that. And he's like, yeah, this is all stuff you're supposed to do. I mean, that, you know, that would like really just upset me. And you're like, so now it's like, well, what else am I supposed to do? What else am I supposed to learn about? And I think it's just brought so much more fulfillment. And like you know, you stepped out, you got pushed out, and now it's like what you love to do. You know, I think that happens very often for people.
Yeah. And just like you said, like you're built to do certain things. Like certain mm-hmm. people have an eye for, you know, design, like maybe it's interior mm-hmm. design or decorating and all that kind of stuff. Or other people have an eye for, you know, they're better at, you know, like more people skills and stuff like that. Right. But you don't know necessarily what those skills are that you're good at and that you, mm-hmm. That you will enjoy doing and what your purpose and what your passion mm-hmm. is going to be until you put yourself and put yourself in those positions where you're trying to do some of these things. And mm-hmm. You may try some of these things and you may find out that's totally not for you. It's not the thing that you want to do, but at least you know that. And so mm-hmm. you don't waste your time going down that path of this, whatever this thing is that mm-hmm. you're not meant to be doing. That mm-hmm. frees you up now to go pursue other things that yeah. you're going to be more passionate about, that you're going to be, just internally, you're just going to be better at, because, that's just how you're built and everything. Yeah. So,
You don't tend to find I don't find that you tend to find some of those, things that we talk about, what your passions are and what you really are great at, while you're sitting in the cage of your own mind, like these, right. these self-limiting beliefs that you're talking about. If I'm just sitting in the cage and I'm not willing to go outside, and I got the key in my hand, I'm just not willing to unlock the door and walk out myself. I'm just not going to be able to see what potential is out there. And you will have to run into things that you don't like and you're not happy with, and that you don't like doing and you're not good at, maybe. And those are even opportunities to show character. I say this often. It's like, people that put in great effort and enjoy and just only want to do the things that they're good at or that they want to do, that's called normal. That's normal. Who doesn't, right? But right. like the people who are willing to put in that same effort into things that they don't want to do, or that they don't necessarily know that they're going to be good at, that's called character. And I think that, developing character is also outside of that comfort zone as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anything that you do that's new, a little bit scary, mm-hmm. pushing you in directions that you wouldn't typically go in, is going to help you grow. Even if that thing that you try ends up in, let's just call it a failure. I don't really mm-hmm. think of it as a failure, but mm-hmm. if it turns out that it's not the thing that you find yourself passionate about, or mm-hmm. it's something that you've tried, didn't succeed. Like for example, if you went to the, that family readiness center mm-hmm. and you started working there and you just were blowing it and it wasn't mm-hmm. like you just weren't getting it and you weren't doing a good job there or whatever, at least you've tried, right? And mm-hmm. and now you know, okay, well, this type of work is not really for me. This is not the type right. of thing that I need to be doing. But you tried it, you did it, and you succeeded, and that helped you advance in your career. So, I think either way, whatever the outcome is, it's going to be helpful in terms of pushing you in the right direction. It may push you away from certain things because you try something and you're like, okay, that's not for me. But it could also push you towards certain things because it's going to just help you figure out what is or is not the path that you want to take.
Yeah, it's all feedback, and I think yeah. that in life, we always think that, somebody's supposed to sit down with us and give us all this feedback. And no, and I even said this to my team the other day when I was welcoming some new engineers to my unit. And I was saying, not everybody deserves feedback, and then they kind of look at you like, what? This is completely against the bumper sticker that we've been pushing. No, not everybody deserves feedback. If you're not, willing to receive feedback with an open mind, open heart, and without excuses and externalizing all the reasons why you can't or whatever, right? You don't deserve feedback. Who wants to keep giving feedback to somebody who's always making excuses and not willing to try new things? And life, and also what I was alluding to is that we should also be seeking feedback in ways that it's not just necessarily a formal feedback session. Like life is giving you feedback every day. There's stuff happening. My knee hurts in the morning. There's some feedback. I'm getting feedback throughout. I eat something that doesn't work out well for my stomach. That's feedback, And what's not said, that's feedback, yeah. in conversations. And I think that we need to be able to all become students of human behavior, especially as leaders, to identify where that feedback's coming from and what we can take from it. And the more you expose yourself to outside of your comfort zone and things that the more feedback you're going to be able to receive and hone and understand. And this is for me. This is not for me. This is something I want to do, but I'm not great at. And maybe I can still, keep trying and gain more from that. But you have to be able to expose yourself to some more feedback or you'll never get there,
Yeah. And I think I may have the number wrong here, so don't quote me on this mm-hmm. percentage, but I think as far as communication goes, I think it's somewhere around like 70 or 80% of communication is nonverbal. communication. Right. It's your mm-hmm. body language. It's how people are reacting to things. So you're talking about feedback, right? And it's, you know, if you're interacting with someone and they're giving you this look like, you know, who is this guy, you know, whatever, you know, like that's some feedback for you. Right. And, or if they're looking at you like in awe, like they're, oh my gosh, this is so amazing. Oh, that's more feedback. Okay. You're doing something mm-hmm. right there. Right. So it's important to pay attention to all the feedback. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like you were saying before, you might have a pain in your body or, you know, something else. There's just feedback all around us. And, mm-hmm. and it's really just opening up our eyes and our ears, all of our senses really to receive that feedback and understand what it is that is going on around us. Right.
Yeah. I think that, and you bring up a good point. There's like, you know, you gotta be aware. You gotta like be willing to kind of be in that stillness and do some inner work. And I think that's what happens a lot. We don't we get angry and then we don't really do the time to think, what's that an indicator of? You know, what's going on here? Why am I angry about that thing? Or, you know, and we just kind of roll with it. We just let feelings dictate how we're going to behave, you know, and I think, you know, understanding that internal feedback as well, there's so many, the world is full of feedback. So when somebody says, I don't ever get feedback, I'm like, well, you're just not paying attention, man. Right. You're just not paying attention.
Yeah, exactly. It's everywhere. The feedback is all around us. I want to switch gears just a little bit here, real quick, if we could. When we chatted a few weeks ago, we also talked about your return from your deployment to mm-hmm. Iraq, and how difficult it was for you to find people who you could talk to that understood what you went through, right? You came back just as a kind of background. You came back as a single airman, and you were basically in the barracks, you know, just kind of hanging out on your own for a little while. So what was, first off, like, what was that deployment like and kind of what went on there, and what were some of the difficulties that you faced after getting back from that deployment?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you letting me share that. So that was my first deployment that we were talking about. I was a young airman deployed out to Kirkuk, Iraq in 2003. So if everybody remembers, that was the invasion time. So it was about March 2003. I remember we were sitting in Al Udeid watching some of the bombings, and then we moved in immediately right after that to basically repair. That's what engineers do when we go blow up stuff. We go back in there to fix it to make it ours now, right, and usable, right? So we go into this deployment, and it was bare base, and that's what a lot of engineers do. We have to go into an environment that's is very contested potentially, and not very secure, and we're setting up everything from scratch. So in that the environment was, we were pooping into ditches and then burning it ourselves. You know, we were eating MREs for 90 days. And then finally they gave us T-Rats, which is not much better than an MRE so meals ready to eat. Some people, you know, for our civilian audience, I don't know if there's anybody listening that won't know what an MRE is, but they're very nutritious, but they're not always yummy. They've gotten better over the years, but back in 2003, they were still not the best. And 90 days of that really starts to wear you out, you know? <Sure. laughs> And then we started getting, the army came in with the kitchen and we had the T-Rats, which is basically just a bigger MRE that's put on a plate and put in a microwave and given to you. So that wasn't that much better. And you had to walk to go get those. So we just stuck with the MREs. We were popping malaria pills nonstop. And, you know, and I remember walking around, the base wasn't very secure. It looked like something from like a Vietnam movie. I mean, like the guys were out there taking quick showers with water bottles, shaving with water bottles. I saw a kid walking on the base with a goat and I'm like, is that kid supposed to be here? And like, we don't have enough security to keep a perimeter right now. I'm like, oh joy. Wow. It was just amazing. We were armed when we got there. And then, you know, there was no lights because one, we were trying to keep the light, the, you know, just our, footprint a little bit more quiet, but at the same time, we didn't have a lot of power on the base yet because we blew it up, you know? So that's what we were there to power it back up. So this was a really, and I'm really grateful that was my first deployment. You know, I mean, some people, there's different types of deployments, quote unquote deployments. Some people will go to places that are very set up, almost like a home station, except over in a deployed environment. This one was, to me, a great first deployment because it made me really feel gratitude and appreciate some of the things that, you know, not take for granted some of the things we do, like taking a shower and a warm shower and being able to go to the bathroom in the same building that you're in. You know, these are things that, you know, I learned from that. I gained a lot from that as a young airman, but it was a rough deployment. A lot of small arms fire. This was before all the rockets started coming in a lot, but a lot of small arms fire. I look up at the skies and see tracer rounds all night. It looked like fireworks. It was just wild. Pretty much worked 7 days a week. And one day we tried to sleep in, but you felt bad because then the guy who's coming off shift, you know, he has to stay on for the next couple hours. So we tried to be really considerate of each other, slept where we worked where we slept. But we got really close during that time. You know, we got really, really close. And we didn't have anything. We didn't have TV. You know, that would play a lot of cards on downtime. Guy had a guitar and we'd all just kind of sit around and sing and stuff. And it was really cool. Sounds probably corny to most people in this world of technology we have, but I felt like we're at peace, you know. Deployment's over. And I realized the deployment was about over and it was time for us to go home when the new people came in and we built this place from scratch, but they thought, man, this place is trash. And we're all feeling offended. Like, we just built this up from nothing. Yeah. And y'all are judging this, you know? And so it was time for us to leave. We go back home and I was at Robbins in Georgia once again. And then, you know, we were really close. We were really tight. And then everybody just splits up and goes back to their normal lives, you know? And a lot of people got picked up by their spouses, you know, or their family. And they had the big sign that said, welcome home and all that stuff. And then single airman Joe Bogdan gets home and there's none of that for me. You know, there's none of that. And I just go home. And everybody else is at work and I'm sitting at home and we get R&R time. And that's like, hey, you could use R&R time or you can use your leave and go home, but and you'll like negate your R&R time. That's free time off. I was like, well, I'm not going to do that. You know, that's stupid. Yeah. So I'm sitting around for 2 weeks. I did all my in-processing, got my medical checkups, which was not much back then. We're doing a lot better at that now. And then I sat there for like 2 weeks. All my friends were at work. All the people that I was engaged with at deployed, they were all spending time with their families, you know, and stuff. So I didn't really have anybody to talk to. And then I'd call home to home and back in Seattle and I'd talk to some people, but my family, but they don't understand what I went through. You know what I mean? I could bring it up and they're trying to empathize, but it's hard to connect it. And then eventually I was like, well, what's the point in sharing this with people if they don't really grasp it? I'm not really getting a lot from this besides they're hearing cool stuff. And maybe I'm stroking my ego saying about the cool things I did, but I'm not really feeling connected to anybody. And I just felt really lonely. You know, you feel kind of dark. I got in a dark place and, you know, if an airman or a soldier or anybody came up to me now and told me about, you know, the feelings that they're having, if they were similar to the ones I had when I was that young airman in that situation, I would tell them they need to go get help. You know, but I didn't even think about going to go talk to somebody. I went to the bottle. I was drinking every day, just waiting my time out for this free time off before I can go home and connect with my family. And there was a lot of day drinking going on. And I just remember, and I think that helps shape my, I never had a thought of hurting myself, but I definitely felt empty inside and disconnected and back in a world that I felt didn't really have anything for me at the moment, you know? And I think back at that moment, when I have my team, my young engineers go out and come back. I always think about that single airman that has to go back to that empty barracks. Yeah. Or, you know what I mean? I wonder, I was like, how are they going to be taken care of? A lot of them, they don't want you to be engaged with them. They just kind of want to be on their own. But how healthy is that? Because it wasn't healthy for me. And I think just the fact that I was so independent growing up and been myself a lot probably helped me feel comfortable being by myself. But a lot of people aren't like that. You know, you grow up in a family, you have a lot of people around you a lot. You go deploy, you come back and you're in an empty room with nobody there. I can imagine some of the dark thoughts that could come across, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to bring this up is because, when I deployed, I was married. I didn't really think too much about this. But mm-hmm. I did have some soldiers who were under me who weren't married, and they, I didn't really think too much about, who were they coming home to? We were National Guard. So we weren't like stationed on a base anywhere, like where they were going to the barracks. They were going back home to whatever their life was, but, they may have just been living alone. And, it's just kind of something I never really thought too much about. And then you brought that up a couple weeks ago, and it started making me think like, okay, he's not the only single airman or soldier or, whatever in the military. And people probably have gone through something very similar where they're just hanging out for a couple weeks. And like you said, just drinking the time away just doing that as opposed to, maybe something constructive or, right. Getting help if they needed it. But they're just sitting there alone in their own thoughts maybe. And mm-hmm. that's a difficult place to be in.
Yeah. I think that, it took a while for me to understand what was going on there too. Cause I think that a lot of times when you're young or even not young, this is the first time you experience something like that, right? Come back and then you're just like, why am I feeling this? I should be happy. There's a disconnect between I'm happy I'm home versus why did it feel like I kind of want to be back over there? And, it took a while for me to, I kind of started understanding that even throughout my, later years in the military, kind of going through this experience because, I've been what I would consider a single airman most of my career, and I read the book Tribe by Sebastian Younger. And that's when I started connecting the dots. And they talk about how there's people who were getting bombed in in country like Serbia or something. And they were with their family though, but it was a dangerous environment, but they were with their family, people that they loved and they were connected with. And then sometimes the parents would send their kids someplace else because it's not safe there, but they couldn't leave themselves. So they send their kids and the kid would be in a safe environment but away from their family and completely depressed and feel more connected and happier in an environment where their life is in jeopardy every day, being connected with people that understand that, And when I read that book, I was like, my goodness, this is describing exactly what me and many service members go through. Even if you come home to your family too, Scott, I think you've probably, you've experienced it. We shared the stories too. You still don't feel like you're connected because they don't understand what you went through. And you can try to explain it, but they never will. And then eventually sometimes we quit trying to explain it. And now we're by ourselves in a house full of people. Yep. And that's, I think that's just the reality of the human condition and some of the unnatural things that we're putting our service members, are experiencing because, we all volunteer for it, but it's something that we're experiencing that we need to acknowledge.
Yeah. And actually, as you were mentioning that, it just reminded me of another experience I had. So when I was coming back from Afghanistan, this was right after my brother was killed in action. I was on my way home. I was not with anyone from my unit. I was traveling basically by myself. I was with other service members who were on their way home, but a lot of them were on their way home for their leave or for end of the deployment or whatever. They were all excited to be going home. They had something that they're looking forward to, like, okay, I'm going on R&R and I'm going, wherever. And I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's like, I'm dreading this. Like, I don't want to go home. I don't want to face what's waiting for me at home. All the realities of what had just taken place. And I had nobody to share that with. I had nobody to talk to, and even though I wasn't by myself, it was very lonely. And it was just a strange situation. I'd never felt so alone in a room full of so many people, right? it was strange. I wanted to bring that up because I feel like That's something that's important for especially senior leadership in the military to understand about the people who they're in charge of. Because like you said, we deal with all sorts of these HR things, right? In the military, like that's just right. Part of what we do. And you have to pay attention to even those types of things too. After everyone's home and everyone's safe, you did your job, you got everyone home, everyone's accounted for. But even afterwards, you need to follow up with them and make sure that they're doing okay. Even when they're sitting at home by themselves, you know?
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's something you brought up because we talked about how like we're basically human resource, human relation monsters, you know, because we do so much of that. We're also really good at compartmentalizing and avoiding, you know, I was thinking about it on many occasions, you know, we're really good at just compartmentalizing in situations like, okay, I got to take care of mission, so I can't worry about that. But I think that somehow bleeds into this. I don't feel like dealing with that, so let me just go ahead and avoid that at all costs by compartmentalizing more and being more focused over here. And that, you know, I've seen it many times. That ends up with relationship issues at home and just being disconnected and stuff like that. So I think it kind of piles on, you know, into, you know, just this issues, the issues that we have with our service members. I remember coming back from, I went to a professional military education course for so many weeks, and, you know, a lot of people are looking forward to going home, and I'm like having, at that time, a lot of marital issues, and I'm just trying to avoid the whole situation. I'm like, no, I want to stay here forever, man. Don't send me home. I get to be in this hotel and work out all the time. And, you know, it was, you know, fantastic, for me in that situation, but it wasn't solving anything. It was just prolonging and procrastinating and not dealing with the issue.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right. We do tend to compartmentalize a lot of things, and it makes it, you know, sometimes it makes it harder to deal with things because we end up just putting it off and not mm-hmm. dealing with it head on. Before we wrap this up, I wanted to give you some time here to tell us about, I mentioned it earlier, the Llama Leadership and Llama Lounge, the podcast, and you know what they're all about and where people can go to find everything that you're doing, everything that you're putting out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Llamas, there's five of us. We started off with four, and we were all E6s in the Air Force. We were all from very different career fields. But we all had this connection that we wanted to help people grow, grow leaders, grow ourselves. And we really, that master resiliency training was what connected us, because I became the person that was the expert on my base. And then I had to start teaching others to become instructors as well, and started advocating for people that really seemed to just have that, not just the aspiration, but also the aptitude to be able to do this well. So I got connected with some guys, and they were just fantastic. And then we just became friends, and we started always supporting things. And we had a special needs event come. And because I'm sharing this because people always ask, why are you guys called Llamas? You know, Llama Lounge, what is Llama Leadership about? Right. There was a random llama at this autism event that we were supporting. And somebody asked, like, why is there a llama over there? And it wasn't a petting zoo. It was just one llama just randomly in the field. And I think I just answered like, well, why wouldn't there be a llama here? And next thing you know, we just kind of took it as our mascot. And we were friends, you know, kept on staying in touch with this goal and idea of one day creating a consulting company, basically, like to help with leadership and growth and resiliency. And years later, I was, you know, on a treadmill in Spangdahlem, Germany, listening to Tim Ferriss, and thought, man, we should do something with this. Finally, we've always been friends, but we should do something. So three active duty E9s and one retired E8. We're all together, and we decided to create this thing called Llama Leadership, which we started off with blogs, which we still have plenty of the blogs on our website at llamaleadership.com. And then we started podcasting. We wanted to start interviewing awesome people like you and talk to people about perspectives on all things life, learning, and leadership. So we've, you know, we're in the hundreds of episodes, 130-something, 140-something episodes now. And, you know, we've interviewed and just had just meaningful discussions with people of all backgrounds. We've had FBI behavioral analysts on, service members, leaders from different branches, everything from generals to chiefs to airmen, you know, like just different conversations, all things life, learning, and leadership. And it's just been a great experience. So you can find the podcast Llama Lounge on all platforms, you know, whether it's Amazon or Audible or Spotify. You can find it in all the podcast platforms and llamaleadership.com. We try to put out references and resources to people that they can utilize. And you can check out our blogs. We also put quick 2-3 minute inspirational, motivational thoughts a week. Plus we had the full long form conversations. And then we've also recently started doing short clips that you don't have enough time to listen to a whole episode, but you have maybe 20 minutes. You can listen to a good, a part of the episode that we think was just bring a lot of value on its own, you know? So a lot of stuff we're pushing out there, and we're part of the Lima Charlie Network, which is a group of podcasters that, you know, have some affiliation to the military, but we all provide different types of content. So it's just been a wonderful ride, and check us out, llamaleadership.com. And you can also find us on all social media platforms under Llama Leadership.
Yeah. And I'll have links to all of that in the show notes too. So anyone who wants to check out Llama Leadership and the Llama Lounge podcast, you can find that all in the show notes. So it'll make it nice and easy for you to grab that there. Joe, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. I think you know, some of your experiences and how you've grown throughout your career and your time, not only just in the military, but just, you know, in this country after you know, coming here and how you've grown and progressed and everything. It's you know, awesome to see the progression that people take and how certain challenges push them into where they are today and help them grow into to better leaders, better people. And you know, that came out in your story. And I'm glad that you're able to share that, because it's encouraging that you know, someone who faced challenges didn't really know you know, where their purpose or their direction in life was going to take them, you know, ended up finding their purpose. And you know, I think the inspiring part about that is that I don't think that the story is completely unique, because I think other people can do the same thing if they give things a try and try to find their purpose, right? And that's the thing that's inspiring to me, is that there's hope for those people out there who maybe are kind of wandering around and not really knowing what their purpose is in life. And you know, your story showed that it is possible. And I think you gave some good steps in how people can get that in their own life.
Yeah, awesome, Scott. Yeah, I really appreciate it. You know, this conversation, this constant quote's been going in my head. A Dr. Viktor Frankl quote, and he talks about, we detect our meaning in life. You know, we detect it. We don't invent it. We detect it. And I think, like we talked about, you have to expose yourself for as many opportunities to detect it as possible for you to be able to truly not just find it, but embrace it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a great quote too. And it's totally true. I'm glad you shared that. So, thanks again for coming on and sharing your story. And again, for everyone listening, Llama Leadership and the Llama Lounge podcast, I'll have links to those in the show notes. You can check that out there, and definitely do check out the podcast and subscribe to that. Listen to it. Joe has had a lot of great guests on that podcast, a lot of great insights and inspiration coming out of there too. So definitely check that out. So thank you again, Joe. I'm glad you were able to come on and join us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.